music I listen to is from here. Like, I'm very connected to this culture, you know.
That's Blue House. I'm Jamie Green. And this is Trading Fours.
I'm going to Kansas City.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Trading Fours. I'm your host, Jamie Green, and yes, I am back. Did you miss me? Did anybody miss me? Anybody? Maybe somebody. I don't know. If you missed me, email address is down there in the show notes. Shoot me an email. You know, last episode was Eric Dover. That's been over a month ago. But that was my most popular episode ever. Eric was cool and tons of downloads, so I'm going to keep up the good fight, man. Even though I haven't heard from anybody, I'm going to keep it up. Hey, today, we've got the amazing Blue House. Because, you know, if you think blues music, you totally think an Argentinian. But you know what? He's really good, and it really works. So we're going to get to that in just 1 second. But before we do, we need to talk about today's sponsor. Campfire Audio. Campfire Audio makes top-notch quality earphones for music lovers alike. Whether you're a musician, producer, or audiophile, Campfire has the perfect product for you. They've got a small team of highly skilled and dedicated craftspeople. They continuously experiment with materials and techniques to create something unique and special for the people that care about it most. Probably people like us that are listening to a podcast like this. Each model in their earphone line is designed and assembled by hand in their Portland, Oregon workshop. Their earphones are second to none in performance and finish. So down in the show notes, I've got the link to that website. Check it out. Campfireaudio.com. All right, even though you I've been gone for a while, I'm pretty sure you know what I'm going to say. Let's get started. Here's my conversation with Blue House. So I think a good place to start is the album is out, and it's been out for about 3 weeks, right? It came out August 6th, so tell me, what kind of feedback are you getting?
Yeah, it came out August 6th. It's my first solo album ever, because I used to be in another band called Stone Giant, but now this is like the first time that I released a solo album, and I don't know, it's been great, you know? It's been great. People are listening to it, are sharing, you know, people that know me from other bands tell me that they really like this new sound. I feel more comfortable with the sound because it's like I wrote everything, and I don't know, I just feel more identified with it. I was just in LA and we did this, you know, jam in the van when you perform in the van.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, so we did that performance, and we played a couple songs from the album, like four songs. And I don't know, the vibe just felt great. The people loved it. So the feedback has been really cool, you know, but I feel like it's only starting, so I'm excited to see where it's going.
No, that's great, and I think people are going to recognize pretty quickly off that you are not from the Mississippi Delta. you have a very interesting background. So, you know, I was trying to think about, you know, and Americans, and I'll probably get slagged for this, but it's true, Americans are kind of self-centered. We kind of, you know a lot about America, but don't know a whole lot about Argentina. I mean,
yeah.
I think what if you ask people about Argentina that are Americans, they're probably going to say, you know, Evita the musical. They might remember the Falklands War. they might be able to tell you that Buenos Aires, you know, a little bit about that. But that's about it. So from your side, what does America get wrong? What does America need to know about Argentina that they don't?
I mean, Argentina, of course, we're very known for soccer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're huge in soccer, but if you focus on the music scene, Argentina is a very powerful rock and roll place. You know, there's great bands that came out in the 70s that were kind of like imitating what Sabbath and all these people are doing. I'll have to send you a list. I think you're gonna like it.
No, sure.
You know, so there's been like a really cool classic rock era also in the 70s and the 80s. Plenty of bands, you know, go tour Argentina and they just love the energy of the crowd. You know, I'm talking like big bands, you know, like I've heard Slash say Argentina is one of the best places to play. I know AC/DC did a world tour and they filmed every concert, and then they decided on one night to release it on DVD, and that was the show in Argentina. Just because the people are so, it's like they're watching a football game, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy that you get when you play live there,
and it's huge stadiums.
I think if you experience a concert, a rock and roll concert in Argentina someday, you're gonna really like it.
Well, I've always wanted to see Buenos Aires. I've always wanted to go, so it's on my list. I just got to get two kids through college.
that's a priority, right?
Yeah, well, that's not cheap, man.
Yeah, of course.
So, so you're growing up in Argentina, and I read your bio, and you hear it was just Jimmy Page and Led Zeppelin. What all were you hearing down there that made you decide, hey, I like this and I want to do it?
Yeah. I mean, I lived in Argentina all my life, and I came to the U.S. I mean, I always come to the U.S. since I'm like 2 years old. I have family in the U.S. The music I listen to is from here. Like, I'm very connected to this culture, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I know about this Argentinian bands and everything, but even when I was there, what really brought me to this is what you said, Led Zeppelin, Jimi Hendrix. I wasn't really listening to a lot of, like, Spanish rock and roll or Argentinian bands. I was really focusing on Eric Clapton, on Stevie Ray Vaughan, on ZZ Top, you know, and that's why I started, when you talk about that craft, I started really developing that craft by listening to these guys, you know, and started playing in bands and learning the songs, spending hours on that blues scale and then trying to sound like Santana, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really spent some time, probably when I was like 17, and 18, like, really spent some time studying those sounds until I decided to just go to Berkeley.
Yeah, that's interesting. So a lot to unpack there, but I think it's really it's kind of that cliche that people say that music is the universal language, but I think it really is, because if you let's say, so for you, for instance, all those guys that you talked about, whether they're the American side with Stevie Ray Vaughan or Billy Gibbons or if they're Hendrix, and then the British guys, well, all that goes back to the blues. Those guys were all listening to Freddie King,
Absolutely.
Albert King, Lightning
Freddie
Hopkins.
Albert King, Lightning Hopkins.
Yeah.
Robert Johnson. Yeah, I love that sound as well. And how you notice that it evolves, right? You hear something from the 30s, like Robert Johnson, like very acoustic, and then you go into the 50s, and then it just starts evolving until you have Black Sabbath, basically.
Right. Well, I don't think most people think about the Stones. They're like, oh, the Stones are a rock and roll band, but the Stones wanted to be a blues band. That was what they were, a blues cover band. That's how it started.
Absolutely, yeah, of course. That rock and roll sound comes from the blues.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
I don't know much about it, but even jazz comes from blues. Just wanting to get out of the blues, that's when you start jazzing things up too.
Right.
But the essence of it is blues as well.
Yeah. Well, didn't they teach you that at Berkeley?
Yes, there are some music history classes. Everybody's very jazz oriented when I went there, but we kind of turned the school into a more rock and roll school, to be honest.
So for people that don't know, and one of the reasons why I do this podcast is it's try to kind of give people a behind the scenes look at music if they're not aware of it. So Berklee School of Music is a very famous music school in Boston, Massachusetts.
Yes.
That has put out a lot of great musicians. You know, Mike Stern, mm-hmm. who played with, you know, Miles and everybody. I think he teaches there.
My friend Juan, he's the drummer of Mike Stern right now in New York.
Right.
he's always been like very into that movement.
Right. And so
yeah, Berkeley is a community too. It's like wherever you go, there's going to be Berkeley people, you know?
Yeah. So what was the calculus for you? Because I think a lot of guys that are more, hey, I want to do the rock and roll thing. It's more the GIT school out in Los Angeles. I know like Jeff Buckley went there and some other folks. So what made you say, hey, I want to do Berkeley?
I don't know. I mean, I had some friends in Boston at the time, you know, because I went to American school in Argentina. So most of my friends were already studying in the U.S., but I had stayed in Argentina when I was 17 to play with a band. And then I kind of split up with that band. And everybody was just telling me, yo, you got to go to Berkeley. You got to do this. So for me, it was just Berkeley. I didn't apply to anywhere else. I went to Boston. I auditioned. There was no plan B. I got in, you know, and I don't know. It was just great. The people that you meet, what you learn, the facilities they have, the studios, the rehearsals. It's just a whole combination that is just great. And yes, when I came to Berkeley, it was very jazz. I remember like my teachers, even the first two semesters, they made me play jazz. I would be playing like Charlie Parker or Wes Montgomery on the final exams. You know, like I was coming from rock and roll and I pushed myself to learn that. And I saw I could do it, but it wasn't really in my language. So then more like third semester and on, I said, you know what, I'm going to start doing rock and roll. So I switched from like playing Charlie Parker to doing like the Comfortably Numb's guitar solo on a guitar exam and stuff like that. And then we formed the band and we were playing a lot in Berkeley and the bars, and then other bands started joining and we started like this rock and roll movement, and then the graduation with Jimmy Page.
Right.
And since then you see like a growth in rock and roll in the Berkeley community that I feel like the whole movement that we did and the people that was there kind of opened it up.
So what year would this have been when you graduated?
This was 2014.
So I mean, obviously, anytime I have somebody on that I have a press person, they send me the packet. I always read the packet and I always listen to the music. I always try to be prepared. So I'm sure you probably get asked this every time because it kind of stands out that Jimmy Page, now, you invite him to your grad. I'm guessing if I invited Jimmy Page to something, he's going to tell me no, if he even hears from me. What was the connection? How did you connect with them?
Yeah, this is a story that it's with me forever, you know, and I don't mind telling it. Sometimes I go into a lot of detail. Sometimes I just tell it more simple. But basically, when I was in my teenage years, I met someone, and through that personal connection, it ended up being that they were connected to Jimmy. So when I was 19, it was like really the moment that I was very into Led Zeppelin and like starting the bands and doing all that stuff. And I actually went to London and I met his family. I met him. He saw me play. We had a nice chat. It was a very surreal situation for me, you know, like how did I end up there? You know, I had just started like really getting into Zeppelin and then this happened. And it was just great. I went to London, met him, you know. And from there, I kind of had this feeling that, okay, I need to see Jimmy again, but kind of like through my own means, you know, not just get invited through a family member and go to London. And Berkeley, when you graduate, they have this ceremony, like they do a concert and they invite a big artist and they give them an honorary doctorate. They gave it to like Steven Tyler, David Bowie, Aretha, everybody. So we kind of made this approach, you know, like maybe we should like approach Jimmy Page and invite him to Boston. And I knew I was graduating, but very naive, like not knowing what was going to happen. Then I was on vacation and I got a call that he was coming, you know, and everything just became real from there. And we ended up playing that night. You know, there's footage of us playing at the stadium of BU and Jimmy is in the fourth row. I don't know. It was just it was an amazing experience, man. Like, it's going to be there forever, you know?
Did you get an A? I hope you got an A.
Absolutely. Yeah. The whole semester, like, I already knew that he was coming and that I was kind of like in the insides of this. So I would be already like, you know what, I'm already graduated, you know.
Yeah, I would hope.
I already had that behavior, you know.
That's funny. Well, that's a great, like you said, that's a great, you know, I picked up the guitar because of Stevie Ray Vaughan. I would have freaked out.
Stevie makes you feel something else. He's just one of the best.
Yeah. I'm still sad that he died. It's been 31 years. And I'm still not over it, but I got to see him play 3 times live. So at least I have that. So,
oh yeah.
So
he died the year I was born.
Oh my God. You're making me feel so old.
No, I'm not 19, man. I'm 31.
I know, man. Time's relentless. It doesn't stop for anybody.
It doesn't stop. I saw B.B. King play in Worcester, Massachusetts, and he was 83 years old. Mm-hmm. That was crazy.
Yeah. Well, Les Paul, he's playing every Monday night at the Iridium to his 90s.
Yeah, insane. Yeah,
so that's
the power of music.
Yeah, you're gonna have to keep going, dude.
You got decades
left.
50 years, 50 years of touring.
That's funny. So obviously, this is and I got to listen to the album a couple times.
Thank you.
I listened to it on my bike ride today. Well, one thing, I enjoyed all of it. You know, I'm a rock blues guy anyway, so just I like that feel. You know, your singing style, so much of the blues is phrasing, right? How you phrase and where you come in and how you stuff. And you've nailed it, which is not easy to do for an American, much less.
Yeah.
So you had to listen to just a ton of this, correct, over the years, and you kind of soaked it in and kind of took it and then twisted it and made it your own, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, it was really like that. I mean, I didn't always sing. My idea was not always to sing, you know. The main idea that made me go into this, like many others, is like you see Slash or you see Jimmy, and you kind of be like, okay, I just want to be that guitarist in a band.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you start experiencing these things and you start like writing your own songs, you realize that it's hard to like chase singers. For them to sing your lyrics, to sing your melodies. And at one point, I had this band in Berkeley called Stone Giant that we did a bunch of stuff. But at the beginning, we had another singer, and then he left. And it was kind of like, okay, either we split up or you start singing. And I couldn't even coordinate, like, play the guitar and sing at the same time, you know? And I had never done any lessons, so I just kind of, like, threw myself out there and I just started singing and I started like really, you know, I had already been listening to all these things. I just didn't ever like put myself into the position of singing it. So you start singing and you break your voice, you start like singing with a growl and then you can't talk for 3 days and then you do 4 shows in a row and then you can't talk until you kind of start like understanding how your voice works, you know, and listening to a lot of the blues helps you, you know.
Yeah, because
the gospel singers,
you know, people like you and I get this because we've been around and been in bands and stuff, but I think there's this idea that you're like touched by a god and you're just this great singer. But I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Aretha or Freddie Mercury or Tony Bennett or whoever.
Yeah,
it's the same as you practice your voice. You practice that craft. It's a whole nother dynamic. And like you said, you know, you've got to learn. You can't blow your voice out if you're playing for a 6 month tour and, you know, it's day 3
and
you can't talk. You're in trouble.
Yeah, I mean, as guitarists, like we can go on stage drunk or we can have a fever and, hey, yeah, sure, I'll go play. Oh, I didn't sleep tonight, but we got to play. Let's go. But if you got to sing, any of like the experience you have will affect your instrument, you know? So it's a different world when you're out there singing than when you're just playing the instrument, I feel.
Right. So with this album, had you started it before COVID recording it, or was it all during COVID? Like, what was the timeline on it?
Yeah, I started writing it in 2019. That's when, like, at the beginning of 2019, I kind of decided, you know, I'm going to go solo. I already had the experience of the band and writing with other people. Now I just want to write on my own. And basically all of 2019 was writing demos. I did like 200 demos, you know, not finished, like not 200 lyrics, 200 exact parts, just demos and riffs and melodies. And then by the end of 2019, I already knew what songs I wanted to kind of include in an album or an EP. And then I chose Purify My Soul, which was the first one I released in the beginning of 2020. Mm-hmm. And then I released two more in 2020. And I started but most of the production was during COVID. My friend recorded the drums in LA in a really cool studio called Revival. I think it's a studio of Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Oh, really cool.
And the drum sound was just great. And he sent it to us, and then we kind of did everything here in Miami. I'm also a music producer, and my friend has a studio, so we kind of like took charge of the whole production. And then we finished it. We add more musicians. Then I called a gospel singer because I had that vision that I wanted to try a gospel singer in the songs. So it's been like from writing it to recording it and producing it and releasing it. It was probably a process of like 2 years.
Right.
I could have done it much earlier, but I don't know. I just kind of like took my time with it.
Well, I think that's good too, because it really points out the fact that putting together an album is not something that's done lightly, that like there's a lot of moving parts. And then you throw in the COVID dynamic where you can't probably be in the same room for a lot of it.
Exactly.
Before the vaccine, at least.
Yeah.
That's the bad part. The good part is, I was talking to somebody the other day about this. You know, if this had happened in 1975, before we had the internet, I don't know how any of us survived with it, because you couldn't,
it would have been crazy.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, the internet and since we're talking about music, music has been such a powerful tool for making people just get by every day.
Mm-hmm.
Like with the streamings and listening to music and just how the music, you know, gave people like a companion.
Absolutely.
You know, even when sports weren't around, when you couldn't see your parents or whatever, music was there.
Yeah, and I think everybody likes, well, I hope everybody likes music, right? You know, even sports, there's some people like, oh, I don't care, I hate sports, whatever. But
music is just, is number one.
Right, and it's the soundtrack to so many, you know, of our lives. You know, it's so funny you say that. So I finally got to see a real concert here about 2 months ago.
Nice.
And it was the Summerland tour. So Hoobastank was on it, and Everclear was on it, and then Living Color. And so I'm a huge Living Color fan.
Yeah.
And I kind of got choked up, because it's one of those things, of all the crazy things in the world that you could imagine, the fact that live music would go away for a while.
Yeah.
That's
crazy.
Yeah, you never would have. I mean, you know, musicians are always like, we don't get paid enough, we're not appreciated enough, the label doesn't support us. And I mean, you can have all these things, but nobody's like, oh, the whole world's going to shut down, you're not going to get the play out for a long time.
Exactly. And the live experience is the best, you know.
Absolutely.
That's where it's at. And and it's going to be even more powerful now, I feel. Like, we've never lived such a moment. You know, that when this thing just comes back completely, it's going to be a powerful experience between like the people that are playing with the audience. I mean, it already happened like in Lollapalooza. You know, I saw the video of Foo Fighters playing, and you could already see like the energy. Like, even Dave Grohl was like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm with 150,000 people playing right now, you know?
Right. No, it's very powerful. So what's your plans for this? Are you going to get to tour, or are you going to keep doing the live streaming? What are you thinking?
Well, right now I'm kind of like more promoting, you know. I just went to LA and I did that show, and I really got like, I've been playing in Miami, but not the album, because I just released it. So that really gave me like such a feeling of playing my music live, and it was just a great experience. I feel like this year I'm just going to do some strategic shows here and there promoting the album, you know. But touring and getting into festivals, probably we're looking at next year.
Okay.
I feel like this year is still, it's still, you know, pieces are still getting together.
Yeah.
You know, the big bands are just starting to announce their tours as well. But I'm definitely very eager to go out and play, you know, and just play this album all over.
Well, there's
that's where I feel more comfortable, like on stage, you know.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, I think that a lot of that is, I'm going to use a cooking analogy, right? So when you cook something, you bake something, and it comes out, and it's sounds or it tastes good to you, it's great. But it's much more, you're much more appreciative of the process if you share. Let's say we made a cake, and the cake,
yeah,
and,
exactly.
and you had guests over, and the people were like, "Oh my God, this cake is amazing!" You know, this is so great. And it's the same thing with playing live music: is you get that instant feedback, right?
Exactly, you get that feedback, and like. I love also like when I write a new song that hasn't been released and I try it on the show and see how people react. There's just a whole playing with it that you get that instant feedback, you know, like you stay.
No, absolutely. Two quick things and I'll let you go. I appreciate the time. So you're a left. Well, you, at least you play guitar left-handed. So
I'm a left-handed. Yes.
See,
yes.
I
could have started playing guitar like right-handed, like most people do, but I don't know. I guess I had a teacher that saw the vision and he said, no, this guy needs to remain lefty.
Well, that's funny because that's one of those calcs. So I'm left-handed, but I picked up a guitar when, you know, long before you were born. And it just, for me, for some reason, it felt, you know, my left hand, since I'm left-handed, has much more dexterity. So I was like, oh, that makes sense to me to have that be my hand and I'm forming all these crazy chords.
Yeah, I got you. I don't understand why... It would be different, right? But
well, it puts you in good company. I mean, you and Hendrix and Paul McCartney and right? There's, you know.
Yeah. Did you have a teacher that kind of just made you go right-handed or you just kind of like felt it naturally?
I just picked it up and I thought, oh, this works for me. In fact, it's so funny because then I, you know, because you're a teenager and you're like you said earlier, you want to, these people that you idolize on guitar and you want to be like them. And I'd been playing for like 2 years and I'm like, oh, maybe I should do like Jimi Hendrix. And then I, you know, somebody had a left-handed guitar and I picked it up and I was like, I don't want to do this. I'm going to have to relearn everything all over again.
Yeah,
like,
it's like relearning the whole thing.
Yeah. And then you got somebody like Doyle Brommel Jr. who actually the strings are upside down. So that's crazy. I don't know how he does
you
that.
You get used to it. I can definitely play like that because you get used to it when you go to people's places or whatever and you don't have your guitar. You always have to adapt and play like that.
Mm-hmm.
But to actually make it a career and record it and go out and play shows like that, then that's crazy.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like the sound he gets, because you are limited, but they just don't care.
No, it's not.
They just adapt their playing to that. Doyle, I love Doyle. He has he's a great session player and he actually has some really cool albums.
Yeah, he really does. He comes from a very famous family. His father was a drummer who, you know, co-wrote a lot of Stevie Ray Vaughan songs. He's a co-writer.
They knew, I think he knew Stevie, right, when he was a kid.
Oh, yeah. He used to hang out.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like the Archangels album with him and Charlie Sexton and the guys from Double Trouble. That's a good album if you haven't
heard.
So
he has a great sound.
So for people that are getting to hear you, I'm here in Kansas City and they have not heard you. Are you a Facebook guy? Are you a Twitter guy? What's the best way? And I'll put this in the show notes so they can click. How's the best way?
Everything really. But I focus more on Instagram and on Spotify. You know, but any social media that you use, you can find. My name is Blue House, but you don't write it. As you're hearing it, it's Bluhauz. I kind of like rearranged the word.
Yeah, you sound like early 20th century German art house, right?
Yeah, I later realized that the house written like that is very German.
Yeah, you're confusing people.
Yeah.
No, it's cool.
But you actually say it blue house, like a blue house.
Oh, that's great. So do you know, is there any, have you ever been here to Kansas City? Would you like to come?
I would love to go to Kansas City. I have not been in Kansas City yet.
Yeah. I mean, I know we tortured you with Charlie Parker, who is the Kansas, I think actually today's Charlie Parker's 101st birthday, but.
Oh, wow.
You know,
happy birthday.
There's so much great music history in this town, not just him and.
Absolutely.
Count Basie, absolutely. Lester Young. Right now, Janelle Monáe is, she's huge and she's from Kansas City. Well, that's great. There's a lot of guitar players in this town. You will appreciate it.
I got to get this album on the road, you know, and come visit you and everyone.
Well, that'd be great. Well, it's been really nice to get to chat with you. Your album is self-titled. It is out. It came out on August 6th.
Yes.
So anywhere people get their albums now, they can buy it. And I encourage them to do it.
That's where you get it.
The last thing I'll say, I really appreciate you had a saxophone on a track. Nobody uses saxophones anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. That's Travis Bridges. He's a saxophone player here from Miami. And I called him up. And the solo that you hear on that song was the first take. Like, you know how things are. Like, he came in, he was trying to sound, and then he kind of, like, did this take to, like, warm up. And then we said, okay, let's record. But we were already recording that.
Right.
So, of course, he tried a bunch of takes and improvisations, and then when we listened to everything, we went back to the warm-up, and that's the solo. For some reason, the warm-up was the solo. That's it. That's all he needed to do.
Yes, you shouldn't even have to pay him hardly anything for that.
Yeah.
That happens, though, I think because the pressure's off.
Exactly. You're just warming up. Sometimes it happens. You record something or a solo, and you're like, don't ask me to do that again because I don't really know what just happened.
Right.
You know?
No, that's great. Well, it's been a real joy to talk to you. I wish you the best of luck on the album.
Here.
And if you do come to Kansas City, be sure to let me know, and we'll go out and check out some guitar players here. And then, Blue House, it was very nice to chat with you, and I wish you the best of luck. Blue House, everybody, you know what I'm going to tell you. Down in the show notes, there's links to the album. There's links to his social media. Check it out. He was a lot of fun. Argentinian, Miamian bluesman. There you go. So that's going to do it for this episode of Trading Force. But we're back on a regular schedule, so I'll be back in 1 week. And this time next week, we will be talking to Lawrence Gowan. Lawrence Gowan, who is the keyboardist and singer, one of the singers of the band Styx. And Styx was just here this summer. They're touring all over. They got a new album out. The reviews are great. Lawrence is super cool. He dialed in from Phoenix in the summer. So you know that poor bastard. It's hot. I used to live in Phoenix. It's miserable in the summer. And that dry heat bullshit, that's just a lie. That's Chamber of Commerce crap from the city of Phoenix, because it's not true. It's freaking hot. And then there's the monsoons, and then it's hot and humid. Now, you get into, like, I don't know, mid-late October, it's gorgeous for several months, but don't buy the dry heat thing. I mean, you haven't been there. So that's going to do it. We're going to check out Lawrence Gowan next week, but until then, go out, support live music, and we'll talk real soon. We're going to keep on rolling.